I want to go to that professor at Berkeley, Wendy Brown, who talks about privatization. I think she does a really good, clear explanation of the process and why it's negatively affecting campuses and education in general.
We'll go to that now. This is Wendy Brown at a meeting, Save the University in Berkeley on the UC budget.
Wendy Brown is the Emanuel Heller Professor of Political Science. Also affiliated with the designated emphasis in critical theory, she teaches political theory. A California native, she has been educated and taught by both public and private institutions of higher learning. Her speech tonight is entitled "Why Privatization Is More Than Who Is About More Than Who Pays." Wendy.
I know how to give a speech like Rob Reich, but I'm not going to. In fact, I know how to do all of these, but I'm not going to. I'm actually not going to. I'm actually going to take us over to the dark side for a little while, because there's much talk about privatizing UC, and I want to talk a little bit about what's at stake in that possible future, the future we're very, very seriously threatened with, the future, indeed, that is partly already upon us, but would, if allowed to unfold unmitigated, unstopped, unprotested, would be a very, very serious alteration in what we are, what we do, what this institution is. Privatization means many things. It obviously involves replacing public funding with student fees, growing corporate sponsorship of academic research, increased reliance on endowments, involvement with the stock and bond markets. But at its most basic, it signals a transformation from an institution that is publicly supported and serves a public purpose to one that is organized to sell products to consumers, whether those are students purchasing an education, as Rob Reich just spoke about, or investors purchasing research results. It entails converting an institution that is based on principles of a common good, equality, inclusion, self-governance, and the ineffability of certain kinds of human development and knowledge, converting such an institution to one that is increasingly bound to entrepreneurship, capital appreciation, and is governed by organizational principles of hierarchy, inequality, immediate commodifiability, and applicability of its endeavors. And what I want to do now is just point to a few of the mechanisms and identify a few of the crucial effects of this kind of shift. As you have heard, privatizing public entities and market societies is not new, but we're at a watershed point in its acceleration and in its widespread embrace. For decades, Californians enthusiastically supported public education and other public goods. This changed fundamentally during the Reagan governorship years, 1967 to 75, the years germinating the so-called taxpayer revolts that would eventually catapult Reagan to the presidency. Now, importantly, what was then called Reaganomics, what we now call neoliberalism, of which privatization is a dimension, consists not just in economic deregulation, tax cuts, and so forth. It consists fundamentally in disseminating market values to every sphere of human activity. Within neoliberalism, market principles literally depart the market sphere to organize and govern every domain of human existence. And that means that neoliberalism in particular, privatization especially, involves a forthright assault on the very idea of public goods and values. As Margaret Thatcher, one of the world's most ardent neoliberals and open-handed neoliberals, famously once remarked, there is no such thing as society. There are only individual men and women. That is, could be the motto of what we're talking about here. Now, you can see this process in a nutshell in Prop 13, the 1978 legislation that you've heard about from every single one of us, the legislation that capped the Reagan gubernatorial years. I want to add something to Kevin's history, because conventionally, Prop 13 is described as a populist tax revolt. What's important to remember about Prop 13 is that it was actually a response to court-mandated equality in school funding. That is, it was a retort to the California Supreme Court decisions that required redistributing property tax revenue in order to fund schools in rich and poor neighborhoods at the same level. That would have been a great idea, but what Prop 13 did was make sure there was no revenue to distribute. So Prop 13 was quite literally a rebellion against equality in the name of all those old people who were being pushed out of their houses because of inflated housing prices, but in fact that was not the reality. It was a rebellion against equality. It was a rebellion against the very value of quality public education for all, and it was a rebellion against democracy. The minority rule that it wrote into law was a dramatic subversion of popular sovereignty and a subversion with the market principle that you get to keep what you've earned and no democracy can tell you otherwise. Now, Prop 13 in this regard is a crude microcosm of what was to come. The steady erosion of the very idea of public goods, the erosion of the value of progressive taxation to support them, the erosion of equality as a value in education, and the erosion of democratic principles of governance and shared power, all of which are now fighting for what remains of their lives. Now, at this juncture, we cannot say a simple yes or no to privatization. The beast is already inside the house. What we can do is make the strongest possible case for renewed public support to strive to keep the beast small, contained, maybe even tamed. And to this end, what I want to do and what remains of the time is list 10 things that privatization generates as it brings market principles into the very heart of the university. Each of these is already present in the university in some form, but each of these dire consequences would be extended by the intense and rapid privatization with which we are now threatened. So, privatization entails first, something we've all talked about, decreased commitment to educating California's best students, a shift from meritocracy to plutocracy, a turn away from equal opportunity. As the rush toward out-of-state admissions for revenue purposes makes clear, student access will be, with privatization, increasingly driven by purchase power rather than by who belongs here or whom a public institution is meant to serve, let alone by the commitment to generating social equality through education that several of the previous speakers have talked about. So that's what privatization means first. Second, it means increasing inequality in every strand and strata of the university and a diminished sense of shared purpose within the university. Concretely, this takes the form of huge and unprecedented salary differentials across faculty within and between departments. It means huge and unprecedented differentials in departmental resources, in graduate student funding packages, and in the costs of undergraduate majors and degrees. It also means the departure from the principle that the diverse teaching and research needs and the diverse revenue-generating capacities of the university as a whole that necessarily carry each other, that principle will be departed from. Some research and teaching requires expensive labs or field work. Others require only a great library. Some research has ready external grant support. Others doesn't. Some subjects can be taught only in small venues, like languages. Others can be taught in grand lecture halls. It's only when the whole university has a shared purpose that these differences can be balanced and accommodated. And it's that shared purpose that is absolutely undone by the dissemination of entrepreneurial principles across the university. Third, privatization means decreased support for all elements of the university that are not, as Udolf put it, entrepreneurial. It means decreased support for all aspects of curriculum and research that are not readily applicable or commodifiable. And that obviously especially affects the humanities and arts, the soft social sciences, but it's not only them. Because privatization also means, fourth, deteriorating support for basic research as opposed to applied research. That is, it means not just favoring business over arts and engineering over Shakespeare, it means declining support for exploratory, speculative research in all fields, And that's the kind of research widely understood by scholars as the knowledge fundament from which all applications develop. In other words, privatization means out with Einstein, out with Darwin, out with Aristotle, in with Bill Gates, in with genetic food modifiers, and in with campaign strategists. Privatization means, fifth, research increasingly contoured by and to corporate and state funders. That is, research that's not only curved toward its sponsors, but which often risks overt compromise or corruption by the very need to serve or attract sponsors. This is already a very familiar story in the sciences, and the corrupting effects of big pharma in medical schools is a growing scandal, not only at Harvard, although it's a very big scandal at Harvard, just as Department of Defense recognition that anthropology can be useful to counterinsurgency campaigns is bringing a shower of money, but also controversy, to corners of that discipline. Sixth, and related, privatization means constricted academic freedom on many levels. From containing the free range of imagination and innovation that results from pressure toward application and obtaining corporate sponsorship, to literally silencing faculty who are seen as standing in the way of landing big private donors. And nothing captured this last more chillingly than a tiny incident several years ago during the British Petroleum, Energy, and Biosciences Institute controversy, when our chancellor, formally quite zealous about academic freedom, privately warned a brave young member of the science faculty that persisting in his objections to the BP deal would discredit him and harm his future. Seventh, privatization means increased exploitation of workers. Privatized institutions, and especially privatizing institutions, are historically more hostile to unions, more effective in breaking them, subject to fewer labor regulations and contracts, and more inclined to make use of part-time work that keeps worker associations and bargaining positions weak. More generally, eight, privatization means shrinking from all public values and public concerns. Consider, when the University of Oregon, affiliated with a watchdog agency, merely monitoring work conditions of American companies in the third world, just checking out the sweatshops and the child labor phenomenons, the president of Nike quietly withdrew his $30 million gift to the University of Oregon. And that story has many variations and repetitions over recent years. More generally, as more and more scientific and especially medical research is funded by corporations, incentives openly diminish for research that would serve public purposes. Harvard Medical School, to pick an example, now has three professorships endowed by leading sleep medications, and none, of course, oriented toward the ravaging effects of malaria and AIDS in the third world. And that story, too, is repeated over and over. Nine, privatization means replacing shared governance with business management principles. It means increased influence and involvement by non-academics in academic matters. This takes the concrete form of participation by funders in departments and institutes, and again, we saw that with the British Petroleum and also Novartis events. But it also takes the form of managerially minded university presidents eschewing the power of faculty to set standards and compass points for their university. Finally, 10th. Privatization means education increasingly organized to produce what President Udoff has called efficient instructional delivery systems, that's us, and to generate human capital, that's you. Those were his terms for what UC does and what it offers to the state. And again, I don't think he's the problem, but he is a symptom in this language of what privatization entails. Now, efficient instructional delivery systems generating human capital do not represent education on the model that has just been spoken about, developing, deepening, broadening the mind with perspective, with discernment, with historical consciousness, with diverse knowledges and literacies. Efficient instructional delivery systems generating human capital are not producing thinkers who can apprehend the very processes I am describing, who can trace its history, who can theorize its power, who can calculate its destructiveness, who can limit its losses in art or in poetry. Rather, instructional delivery systems generating human capital are literally producing cogs for the machine, or to update the metaphor, generating new bits of LinkedIn human capital.
That was Wendy Brown. Now I'd like you both to share with us some of the, like, classist, racist bullshit going down at the UC in regards to the budget cuts.
Okay, my name is Laura. I am a senior at UC Santa Cruz, and also have been an intern with AFSCME 3299, which is the Union of the Service Workers throughout the UC system. I've been an intern with them for almost 4 years now. So a lot of the, you know, as I was saying earlier during the clip, that the administration is saying that this is the first, maybe the second round of cuts. I mean, we saw the first round of budget cuts last year when the Community Studies program and the Latin American and Latino Studies program were being cut. You know, meanwhile, science programs weren't being cut as much. And it was kind of this decision on behalf of Dean Kamieniecki of the Social Sciences Department that these were programs that weren't worth saving. These were professors that weren't worth saving and areas of studies that weren't even really that important to the educational system. But economics and, I guess, environmental studies and things that were more mainstream and more that were easier to sell were a lot more important. So when you have the Latin American and Latino Studies program in particular, which is the only ethnic studies program on our campus right now, being cut disproportionately, I mean, that is like the first inherent racist thing I saw within the budget cut. And that there were two lecturers that were cut to halftime and last year and who are being completely fired this year is ridiculous. It looks like the LALS program, the Latin American Latino Studies program, is pretty much going to be falling apart, which affects the students of color who are the majors who are learning about their history in this program that isn't really represented anywhere else on the campus. Which isn't to say that there aren't students of color who are in the sciences or in the mathematics, but it, you know, to pinpoint on the one ethnic studies program. Also, not in regards to academic cuts, but cuts to service workers and campus workers in general, I've seen far more disproportionately happening to them as opposed to the administration. The administration has made these really weak claims that they're taking 1% pay cuts, you know, which is pretty much a slap in the face to somebody who's making $20,000 a year. It's like, oh, you know, you're losing my salary, but you're still making $180,000 a year. So yeah, it's always kind of been the way of the University of California to cut the lowest paid workers first because their labor is seen as less important. I've heard a lot of administrators saying, well, I went to business school, I paid for this degree, I deserve to make $250,000 a year, which is egregious. Nobody needs that much to survive, in my opinion, especially when there's service workers on that campus struggling to get by every day, struggling to feed their kids. Most of them have to commute from Watsonville, and they work second jobs, third jobs sometimes. A lot of them are applicable for WIC and also food stamps, cash aid. It's absolutely ridiculous, and the cuts have only gotten worse, and there's things that the union contract can't even protect workers from. There are already about 36 custodians laid off at Berkeley, and it's just the contract is too weak to even protect folks from that.
Yeah, Laura, you put a lot of good points out there. I mean, there's also eliminating community studies, which is basically the activism department on campus, eliminating almost all the languages, especially Spanish, and then really tackling humanities in general. I mean, and then it gets more pervasive when you go out to a national level. There's cuts in 43 states, in all major state services like healthcare, services to elderly and disabled, K through 12, and of course higher education. Some of these include major attacks on the most vulnerable communities, like instating hiring freezes, cutting Medicaid for mentally ill, decreasing the number of months low-income families can receive cash assistance through the TANF program, cutting salaries, like Laura mentioned, of state employees, eliminating cash assistance to seniors and people with disabilities, eliminating the Department of Health division, eliminating substance abuse services, decreasing homeless shelter capacity, capping child care assistance programs, cutting programs that help prevent child abuse and provide legal services to foster children, cutting HIV services. I mean, these are like, if this will continue, people will be dying as a result of the budget cuts. And it's hard to ignore that these are inherently classist and racist. Taking, for example, HIV services, when 64% of women with HIV are Black, I mean, what is that? There's like no argument against it, you know?
In response to this cutting of human services and education, what has been done to put pressure on the UC? Maybe also talk about how one can get involved with the March 4th strike and, you know, where to go to get involved. Like, what are the organizations? Are there, like, times and places you know offhand to meet?
Oh, well, I mean, there's stuff going all over Northern California. I mean, you got Richmond. A bunch of people are going to Sacramento. There's going to be march there, especially FOG on campus. They're going to send 2 busloads leaving from UCSC. You got marches in Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, Richmond, Pittsburgh, San Jose, Fremont, basically all over the Bay Area. We'll be doing actions or strikes that day. Specifically on UCSC campus, there is a strike committee that meets on Tuesdays around 6:30 or 7. The times are usually tentative. And then other states who have also been drastically affected by the cuts are striking and doing days of actions in solidarity with California. I mean, in Texas, Arizona, Michigan, New York, North Carolina, Florida, Oregon, Washington, the Columbia District. And then you have stuff going on global, like in Greece and France. Yeah. Do you guys want to add to that? I know there's a workers' forum today.
Yeah. There's been kind of a disconnect recently between March 4th organizing, at least in regards to students and workers. We had a meeting about 2 Saturdays ago, and a bunch of the workers were kind of asking us, like, what is even going on? Are we, you know, what's going to be going on with us working? Because in the contract, they aren't legally allowed to strike, and we're going to respect that because people cannot just be losing their jobs and their livelihoods. So there's just a lot of questions out there, and I think that it's really necessary to have a dialogue, a real dialogue, face-to-face with workers and students, or at least, you know, whoever is able to show up, about what people's expectations or what people's thoughts are on what's going to be happening that day, and also giving a chance for workers to say, like, hey, this is how you might be putting us in some sort of risk, and how you can avoid that, how you can support us, how can we support you? How do we just work together? Because it's, you know, it's a larger struggle. It's not just students, and it's not just workers, and it's not just faculty. It's the whole community that's facing these cuts. So that is from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Kresge College on the UCSC campus. Yeah, Kresge 159. It's a seminar room today. So anybody is welcome to come out.
There has been a diversity of tactics being conducted, and there's been a huge global response to it in the reclamation of space. There has been direct action work against the budget cuts, and it's been going on since last spring, with everything from hunger strikes to marches to shutting down roads, holding forums, and whatnot.
Do y'all feel like this is an escalating wave of pressure?
I think there's been various levels of escalation. I think there's been some inconsistencies, maybe. But apparently, these occupations have put pressure on Schwarzenegger, as a, you know, it was cited as the reason that he is going to be cutting prison funding to give it more to education, which probably definitely wasn't the goal in any of these direct actions, to disenfranchise prisoners even more.
In fact, I would love to play that clip right now. Schwarzenegger made a speech on January 6th where, I mean, he says a lot of really important things in this speech. One of the most important ones is pinpointing it, the clash between higher education and the prison system. And a lot of people wouldn't think that the two are inherently connected, but prisons are drastically higher funded than education in the state of California. And so as a result, Schwarzenegger calls for the privatization of prisons to increase funding in higher education.
And we no longer can afford to cut higher education either. The priorities have become out of whack over the years. I mean, think about it. 30 years ago, 10% of the general fund went to higher education, and only 3% went to prisons. Today, almost 11% goes to prisons, and only 7.5% goes to higher education. Spending 45% more on prisons than universities is no way to proceed into the future. What does it say about our state? What does it say about any state that focuses more on prison uniforms than on caps and gowns? It simply is not healthy. So I will submit to you a constitutional amendment, so that never again do we spend a greater percentage of our money on prisons than on higher education. And the way we get this done is to find more cost-effective ways to run our prison system and allow private prisons to compete with public prisons. Competition and choice are always good. I mean, California spends $50,000 per prisoner. By comparison to the 10 largest states, they spend $32,000 only. They spend less, and yet they do not see federal judges taking over the prison healthcare system. Why do we have to spend so much more than they do? I mean, if California's prisons were privately run, it would save us billions of dollars a year. That's billions of dollars that could go back into higher education where it belongs, and where it better serves our future. Choosing universities over prisons is a historic and transforming realignment of California's priorities. If you have two states and one spends more on educating and the other one spends more on incarcerating, in which state's economy would you invest? So I ask you to make the right choices for California.
That was California Governor Schwarzenegger proposing to get money for education by privatizing prison, which is where he's been dumping lots of money over the last few years.
Basically co-opting the movement against the budget cuts. I mean, focusing on the higher-ups, where the money is coming from or not coming from. And his reformist way to combat that is by privatizing the prisons. Of course, we can sit here and talk forever about the millions of reasons why that's a bad idea, especially when he mentions to make it competitive between privately funded and publicly funded prisons. I think another important thing, he mentions servicing the needs